Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. I'd like to open up today with just a short comment I received on the Benghazi programs. Now, I know we're already over 3 weeks into the A Whole Life series, but I thought this comment was so good that it was worth reading to all of our listeners. It says, "Hi, JBL. I want to comment on the 13 Hours panel. Coming from a strong military background, going back to World War I, my grandfather served as a stretcher bearer in Siberia with the Expeditionary Force. I deeply admire the courage and valor these men exhibited in this modern arena of war. They were eager for the battle and were obviously annoyed and upset at all the delays. I have no doubt they could have saved those men who sacrificed their lives to protect Ambassador Stevens. It also made me think of the infamous comment by Mrs. Clinton, which trivialized their selfless sacrifice." And here's a quote. She quotes her, "What difference at this point does it make? How shameful and insulting to the families who suffered through this Benghazi debacle. Keep up the awesome work. Your loyal listener and student." So we do appreciate that comment. And again, any other comments you have, please send those in to JBL. Now today, what we want to do is we want to continue our 60-plus panel discussion of the German-Austrian novella A Whole Life. And of course, that's by Robert Seethaler. One of the marks, I think, of a great writer is the ability to make a character so real that when you're reading about the character, you experience the feeling of being right in the action with that character. Now, I think Seethaler does an exceptionally good job at this with his character, Andreas Egger. And I know our panel is just, we're kind of eager to talk about him. So, Daryl, go ahead, take it.
Well, Andreas Egger, as you know by his name, is actually a German term for a person that is a plower or a harrower. And so you have this sense of a very idyllic, pastoral kind of person living in a pastoral setting. And that pastoral setting is being invaded by technology. And that's one of the aspects of the book, that he's encountering technology moving into this valley and starting to construction on a cable car that's going to bring tourists, that's going to change the nature of the valley, change the way it looks, change the way people interact. And he is ambivalent about this. He has feelings about he wants to participate in this technology. He wants to be part of progress taking place. But then on the other hand, he realizes that this progress is going to bring about a lot of tension and a lot of change in a very idyllic setting. In the book, there's on page 55, if you have the book, there's one section here where he talks about the company which he was a part of that was bringing about this progress. And I'll read at the top of page 55. It says, "The weeks and months after the opening ceremony at the top station were the happiest of Andreas Egger's life. He was himself as a small but not unimportant cog in a gigantic machine called progress. And sometimes before falling asleep, he would picture himself sitting in the belly of this machine as it plowed inexorably through forests and mountains, contributing with the heat and sweat of his brow to its ongoing advance." So he sees this progress as something that he is a part of, and he wants to be a part of that. But then in various places in the book, he talks later about the fact that this changes things. And so the cable car is named Blue Liesel, which Liesel is a typical female Austrian name. So it has, again, this sense of putting, personifying objects to make them fit into nature in this pastoral nature kind of setting. So he really makes you a part of this conflict that you start to sense in the book. this conflict in various areas, not just the area of technology and its impact, but also in the way of nature, the way nature is viewed, that nature is both a peril and it's something very beautiful. And he brings this in a number of circumstances out that really gives the character life, and it helps set a sense of tension in the novel, that even though it's very simple, there is this tension that's there between opposing forces.
If I could just interrupt us a second, I know several programs ago now that I read from the New York Times interview, and they did call it a complex novella, and it really is. It's surprising for as simply as it's written and as well written as it is. Excuse me. It really is complex, and Andreas is a complex character. He's someone that I feel like after reading the book that I'd like to go meet him and talk to him and spend an afternoon with him because it just seems like there's so much you could draw out of him.
Absolutely, and the fact that he's lived a life that probably 21st century people would look at and say, this life is not a full life. This life is not a life of someone who's extremely successful. But his view of it is that he has had a full life. He has had a whole life. This is a whole life, and sort of like whole bread. It's wholesome. It's good for you. And this is a whole life in which he's accomplished a lot of things that are of value from the standpoint of character, standpoint of personality, standpoint of just appreciating the nature that's around you. He has talked about that. That comes out a number of times in the book, especially towards the end. He actually gives what I think is a summary of really his view of life, and that's on page 141, where he really talks about this whole sense of his life passing in this valley. He really hasn't gone out of the valley very much. He's really been a part of nature. He's had a love in his life which has been erased, but he's had a full 79 years of life. And those 79 years, like I say, for someone who appreciates nature, who appreciates the beauty of the individual, who appreciates those kinds of human characteristics and qualities, having all of the accoutrements of a modern life are not really that important.
Yeah, I think I made this comment before, and the sophomore English language students, the English language literature students, I was really surprised to hear them feel that they didn't quite say it this way, but they didn't really feel like he really did much in his life. Yeah, they didn't really feel like he like accomplished a lot in his life. And I was really kind of taken aback by that view, because that wasn't my view at all. I mean, I guess I came from a blue collar family. You know, my father was a blue collar worker, and a lot of my aunts and uncles were blue collar workers, and we weren't necessarily part of the maybe I should say the management class or the, you know, the upper aristocracy of America. But I never considered my father certainly a lazy man. And, you know, he did really take care of us. We had, you know, warm clothes in the winter. We had a steak one night a week for dinner. I mean, there were seven of us. I have six other siblings. I wouldn't have necessarily considered him an unsuccessful person. And so I guess it's really your perspective in life is from where you are in life, how you view this book.
Right.
And it's really not necessarily a young people's book.
No.
I don't think so.
I think this book really cherishes the value of simplicity, and that's something that's not cherished today. But that's very important in this book. I mean, he talks about in his letter back to his now deceased wife when he's away at the war. He writes a letter to her, and he says, basically, you know, I have food to eat and I have work, and that's really all he needs. I mean, it's food to eat and work, and so he was content with that. So he's content with what would be perceived in this society as a very few things, very minimalistic in terms of what he's content with. But that that contentment with those few things brings a lot of joy, a lot of happiness.
Yes. Well, one thing that I think really comes out to me in the book about, let's say, his life, where I think if you're not careful, you miss it. In other words, if you're reading it from a prejudiced mind where, well, he's not accomplishing much, but he was very adaptable. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at how many ways he changed. So he did love being in the mountains. He did love his own little piece of property. He did love the fact that he was able to take care of a small garden and, you know, do all those things. But when they brought the idea of the Blue Liesel in, what did he do? He went to work for them.
Yes.
You know, he embraced it. Mm-hmm. And he even says at this one point, you were just talking about this. Maybe I could read it for you. He says there, this is on page 141, it says, over and over again, he had hung his life on the thread between heaven and earth. In his later years as a tour guide, he had learned more about people than he was able fully to understand. So we know that when he comes back from the war, he knows he can't work, he can't crawl around the mountains anymore. He can't build these big girders. He can't build more Blue Liesels. So what he becomes a tour guide.
Right.
So he's still in the mountains. He still is in his environment, but he adapts and he sells himself to give tour guides and does quite well for himself. And really, I think, brings out some of the best humor in the book when he's talking to these people that are coming to experience the environment he grew up with. And so he's a very adaptable person. And towards the end of the book, I do think it's very interesting how much he loved the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the end of the book, if you really read it, I always have to be careful I don't put too much into it that maybe isn't there. But when he gets his, after he loses his house on the avalanche, he goes around and lives at different properties. And then right before he dies, he digs into the mountain and builds like a cave. It's like he's living inside the mountain now. And so he's very happy. He has a window. He can look out, and he has his table in there. He has his things in there. He has a front door, and but he's got heat. He's got food. He's got a way to grow food. So he's happy.
Right.
But he does love the mountains so much that he's not afraid to live in them. Where a lot of people today, what? You live in a cave? You live in the side of a mountain? What are you thinking? Kind of thing.
Well, especially since the mountain, too, for him, has really played also a cruel role. It's certainly invaded his life in a very spectacular sort of way.
Right.
And yet he still has this love for the mountains in spite of it, which is interesting that he's geared that way.
So I want everyone to know that my wife is here today, too. Deborah's here. So
yes,
what do you think about all this that we're talking about, man here?
Well, yes, I think that there are all different ways to look at his the way that the author brings out aspects of his personality in different ways. And one of the themes is that you've just been talking about is that he is very content and he was adaptable. And Daryl mentioned that some of the things brought tension in his life. And one of the things that brings tension, I think it's interesting to look at the way the women are in his life. And first of all, it seems like he mentions he didn't really understand them very well. I'm going to read this page 116. I like this comment. Let's see if I can find this here.
While you're looking for that, some of the women in his life was obviously his mother, who the book doesn't say much about.
No.
Then there's Nana.
Right.
We do have the funniest scene in the book with Nana.
Right.
And of course, then we talked about Marie last week. Mm-hmm. We talked about the cold lady as well, but there's another woman we haven't talked about yet.
Yes, Anna Holler.
Anna Holler.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say I thought it was funny the way it's written here is that this is some years later after Marie had died, and it says that it had been hard enough somehow to adapt to life again. And under no circumstances did he wish to forfeit the calm that had grown in him over the years. In other words, he was calm and at peace without Marie, without the women. But it says when it when it came down to it, he had barely even understood Marie, and all other women were far more of a mystery to him. He didn't know what they wanted or didn't want, and much of what they said and did in his presence confused him, infuriated him, or provoked him in a kind of inner rigidity which he found very hard to shake off. So he didn't really understand women. But it says there were often moments where maybe a woman, he'd run into a woman, or she would touch him just accidentally. And it says there were often moments like these that had the capacity to stir him, but they occurred less frequently with every passing year, eventually ceased altogether. And he was not unhappy about this. He had had a love, and he had lost her. So Marie, Daryl mentioned last week that Marie was like his fulcrum. And really, that's what was most important was Marie. He had lost her. Nothing comparable would ever happen to him again. That for Edgar was a given. So he accepted that, and he was comfortable with that. But then later on, this woman, Anna Haller, comes into his life and kind of stirs up the peaceful calm.
She forces her way in.
Yes, yeah. She forces her way in. She's a retired school teacher who comes into town to take a temporary position, and she just kind of invites herself into his life, and he really doesn't know what to do with her. At one point, he says he just didn't want to be rude. It's kind of funny. So, and then I think something else is funny is it says she talked all the time. Let's see, page 121. And if we know about Andreas, he did not talk. When he was with Marie, a lot of times they didn't talk at all. But it says that sometimes she said something Edgar didn't understand. She used words he had never heard before, and he secretly assumed that she just made them up when she had run out of all the right ones. So that's what he thought about her and her talking. So eventually, she does. I mean, they are together for a little bit in terms of doing things together, mostly at her insistence. And then she does try to have a physical relationship with him, and he is not able to reciprocate. And really, it's because Marie was his only love, so he really was not really interested in her. So it's more like this episode with Anna is like a disturbance in his contented, peaceful life at that point.
Yeah, she's kind of like the avalanche on the mountains.
Mm-hmm. Right, yes.
Uh-oh. Yeah, but it is. I remember when I first read that, I didn't really get why C. Thaler put Anna in the book. Mm. And but then after getting my wife's point of view, I began to understand that there was something more there. I at one point I thought, well, because he does talk about technology coming, and he even talks about television, and of course one of the other women he really, really enjoys is looking at television about Grace Kelly.
Right.
He really is impressed with Grace Kelly. I think a lot of people were. I've never really seen her in any movies or anything, but I know, I even remember my mother talking about Grace Kelly and how graceful she was, and so he even talks about that. But he certainly didn't feel about Anna like he felt about Grace Kelly.
But I think Anna's role is valuable from the standpoint that she does highlight the importance of Marie to him. That's what I think that whole episode is valuable for, because it's another way of showing that Marie was really so meaningful to him that she was all that really mattered to him in terms of female relationship.
And I think in our society that people can't accept that anymore. If they have a love of their life and that love dies, I mean, that is a big part of life. You have to plan for that. You have to think it's going to happen. But I think there's so much element of society. If you're not with somebody, then you're just, it's not worth it.
Right.
And he didn't believe that.
No.
And, you know, obviously she saw, I think Anna did see characteristics of him that she really liked. You know, she really would have loved to have had a man that could be like Andreas. And if you remember back to the first programs, I said that he was the kind of man that was a man of action. If you needed him and he knew that you needed him, he would act. He would do something to help you. But I just don't think, as my wife just said, I don't think he could reciprocate the love that she wanted because he had already had that and was satisfied with that. Right. And, you know, that's really a kind of a noble thing. And I know I have several friends the same way. Their wife has died and they really don't have a desire to remarry because that was enough. That was,
sure.
And they're content with children and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And there's really nothing wrong with that.
Well, see, and it seems like he didn't mind being alone either. She mentioned something about we are all alone, and so it seemed like she was lonely. Mm. But he didn't seem to have that feeling of loneliness. He was in the mountains. I mean, he didn't need anything else. Marie was, you know, he was satisfied with the relationship with Marie and his memories, and then the mountains, and he wasn't lonely.
That's another amazing contrast that I think Anna provides, mm-hmm. because Andreas has a tragedy with the loss of his wife, but he doesn't let that devastate him. He really comes back. He continues with his life. You don't really see that there's any aberration in his life, you know, as a result of that event. But now, in the case of Anna, she's obviously... she's a loner, but she's obviously suffered from that a great deal, and it's affected her life a great deal.
And I think in some ways it does, if we just follow up on that, if I think about it, it does show that she was not happy that he couldn't reciprocate because mm-hmm. she leaves town afterwards.
Right.
She takes off, mm-hmm. and so right. you know, I do think it's really quite interesting, although I'm trying to get away from saying those words, you know. being a radio host, by the way, isn't that easy. So it's always corrective. But anyway, it is kind of a very, you know, kind of exciting read to read this book. It really does challenge you to go behind, let's say, what's written to see, okay, why would you write a book like this? And I think there's a lot in there. I just mentioned... the word humor. We're gonna quickly run out of time here, but maybe we could just talk a little bit about the humor. And it looks like I put on JBL on Twitter page the other day. It looks like we're gonna have to have a few more programs. So I was hoping to maybe do this in three or four programs. Looks like we're probably gonna have five or six. But let's just talk about the humor in this book. And since we're talking about Marie, let's look at one of the descriptions of Marie. That I really just think it's really kind of warm and touching, but it's really kind of humorous as well. And this is where I think I really would like to be able to talk to Robert, but Daryl would have to go with me to interpret because I don't think he speaks much English. But this is on page 41, and this is a description of Marie from Andreas, and it shows his warm feelings for her, but it also I think shows something quite humorous. He says, at this precise moment, down in the valley, Andreas Egger was putting his arm around Marie's shoulders. So this is the big love scene. I mean, this is the big tender scene that every woman waits for if they're watching a movie or what every woman reads when they're reading maybe a love story. So here's this tender moment. He's ready to put his arms around Marie's shoulders. He says, they had arranged to meet at sunset on the tree stump beside the old footbridge. And to Egger's relief, she had arrived on time. She was wearing a pale linen dress, and her hair smelled of soap, hay, and also, Egger thought, a little of roast pork. So here's this romantic scene, and he's describing it, and not only does he see the beauty, but he obviously smells the roast pork because she does work at the what is it, the Golden Goat Inn, and so. But that doesn't bother him.
That's a pleasant smell to him.
Right.
Yes, it's a good thing. Yes.
He doesn't need Chanel number 5, kind of thing. So notice this, and it gets more tender. He says he spread his jacket over the tree stump and indicated, he didn't tell her, please sit. He indicated for her to sit. He wanted to show her something, he said, something she might never forget. Something nice, asked Marie. He says, could be, he said. They sat beside each other and watched in silence as the sun disappeared behind the mountains. And so the mountains are almost on every page, by the way. If you don't, you have to really go back and read it a second or third time to pick it out. But anyway, of course, we know that scene leads then to the big fire up on the mountain that says, "Will you marry me?" Mm-hmm. So again, I thought that's one of the humor that Seth Haller brings. There's a few other things I want to talk about in our next program. So we are getting pretty close to the end. So I just wanted to say and just remind you that when we complete the programs here on A Whole Life, and we probably have about, maybe two or three programs left, or maybe I should say probably just two programs left. I'll just say it that way. And after that, we are going to begin reading and discussing H is for Hawk by Ellen MacDonald. I have started into it, and I'm just really fascinated with this book. It's about falconry, and of course, in our English classes at the college, we just finished Shakespeare's Henry V, and this falconry really comes back to play. And so I'm really interested in falconry because of reading about the English kings, where falconry was a really big thing in their lives. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook, and that address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.